This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So it delivers at scale. Millions of new cases could be averted and tens of thousands of lives saved every year.
That's WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machi Diso Moeti, on plans for the mass rollout of the world's first malaria vaccine. Details coming up also. The death toll in ethnic clashes in Sudan's Blue Nile state has reached 105. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Preparations are underway for the mass rollout of the world's first malaria vaccine funded by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, for nearly $160 million to protect millions of children in Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Health Organization says Gavi's multi-million dollar funding marks a key advance in the fight against one of Africa's most severe public health threats. It notes that countries in sub-Saharan Africa bear the brunt of the yearly toll of more than 240 million global cases of malaria, including more than 600,000 reported deaths. The main victims are children under age 5. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machi Diso Moeti, says one child dies every minute in Africa, with catastrophic consequences for families, communities, and national development. The vaccine was introduced in Africa in 2019. Since then, more than 1.3 million children have benefited from the life-saving inoculations in three pilot countries, Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. Moeti says those countries have reported a 30% drop in hospitalizations of children with severe malaria and a 9% reduction in child deaths.
So it delivered at scale. Millions of new cases could be averted and tens of thousands of lives saved every year. We were encouraged to see that the demand for the vaccine is high, even in the context of COVID-19, with the first dose reaching between 73% to over 90% coverage.
Managing Director of Country Programs at Gavi, Thabani Mafosa, calls the vaccine the most effective tool in the fight against malaria. He says the vaccine will save children's lives. However, he notes demand for the life-saving product will outstrip supply.
Our challenge during this critical phase is to ensure the doses we have available are used as effectively and equitably as possible. With this in mind, Gavi today is opening an application window for malaria support.
He says the three pilot countries will have the first crack at applying for and receiving funding. He adds that those countries already have experience in rolling out the vaccine, so practically speaking, he says, they will require little help in setting up their systems to get the operation underway. Mafosa says a second round of funding will take place at the end of the year. At that time, he says, other countries that have moderate to high cases of severe malaria will be able to submit applications for support. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda is experiencing a rapid rise in malaria cases. The Ministry of Health says 71 districts across the country have recorded an upsurge. 12 districts in eastern Uganda are reported to be in an epidemic mode. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala. We'll have Nambi later. On August 9th, Kenyans will cast their ballots for president and members of parliament and the Senate. John Mukum Mbaku is a senior fellow for global economy and development at the Brookings Institution and a professor of economics at Weber University. He recently wrote an article titled, "How Kenya's Judiciary Can Break the Cycle of Electoral Violence." Given the country's history of election violence, many people are worried. So I started by asking Professor Mbaku, is there any cause to worry?
Yes, but only to a certain extent. I think that since 2007, 2008, a lot has changed in Kenya to significantly reduce the possibility that we would have the types of ethnic-induced riots that we had in 2007, 2008. This has to do with the fact that in 2010, Kenya had a new constitution that provided significant avenues for citizens to resolve their conflict in a more peaceful way. And we have seen that Kenyans have taken advantage of that mechanism, as we can see what happened after the 2017 elections. The losing party took its issues with the elections to the courts, and the courts were able to resolve those issues properly. Most Kenyans, not all Kenyans, but most Kenyans accepted the decision of the Supreme Court of Kenya. And later on, President Mr. Kenyatta and the opposition leader, Mr. Odinga, had a handshake and initiated a process to change the constitution, to amend the constitution. And there was a lot of opposition to that process. And the people who opposed the process went to court. Both the trial courts, the appeal courts, and the Supreme Court ruled against the government, and the government accepted the ruling. And so we saw that the courts were playing a very important part in helping Kenyans resolve conflicts peacefully. And my belief is that after the election in August this year, if there are conflicts, most Kenyans are likely to prefer to allow the courts to perform their duty, their constitutional function, and resolve those conflicts peacefully. If that happens, I think that Kenya would have reached a point in its existence in which we can begin to see Kenya as a beacon for democracy and the rule of law, not just in East Africa, but also in Africa in general. I believe that Kenyans have the capacity and the willpower to do so, to allow the courts to resolve conflict.
So basically, you're saying the judiciary is going to play a big role in ensuring that the elections are free, fair, and credible. But one thing I would like to point out here is you mentioned in your article that you wrote how Kenya's judiciary can break the cycle of electoral violence. You point out that Kenya is a state that was founded by bringing together distinct groups. It has its own customs, cultures, and traditions, as well as laws and institutions. The challenge you mentioned is the country faces today is how to make these forced marriage work, like you put it, to achieve peaceful coexistence.
Well, the thing is that Kenyans, like groups in other African countries, must at this point realize that even though bringing them together was done through colonialism and we could call it a forced marriage, one of the things they have to realize at this point is that the only way forward is for them to accept the marriage and love each other and try to live together peacefully. And they can, if they look around them in Somalia, in South Sudan, they can see the dangers associated with trying to resolve the marriage forcefully. Because if they engage in those activities and the different groups want to go their own way, they're going to find that it's going to be impossible for each individual group within Kenya, say the Kikuyus and the Kalenjins and the Luo and the Akamba and all these other groups, they're going to find out that it's going to be very difficult for them to survive independently, and that it would create entities that are not going to be economically viable. And so the only way forward for Kenya is for them to live together.
Tomorrow, we'll have the second part of my conversation with Professor John Mukuma Mbaku as he talks about the major presidential candidates in Kenya and who might win. Just weeks before Kenya holds a presidential election, analysts say the unexpected growing popularity of one candidate could deliver some unpredictability to the outcome. George Wajumoya, a distant third behind frontrunners Raila Odinga and William Ruto. But according to one poll, his platform to legalize marijuana is winning support. Victor Amunga reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
George Wajakoya and David Mwaure are newcomers in Kenya's politics, running for president. Opinion surveys indicate that Wajakoya is highly unlikely to win the August 9th election, but his approval among Kenyans is rising. One recent survey by Trends for Insights Africa, TIFA, showed he had an approval rating of 7%, which will translate to about 150,000 votes on election day. The leading candidates, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga and current Deputy President William Ruto, are far ahead at 50% and 25% respectively. But Wajakoya's seemingly small number of votes could conceivably affect the outcome, possibly by denying Odinga and Ruto votes to force a runoff. Mark Bichache is a political analyst in Kenya.
Affecting the election, I don't think he will affect it to the extent where he forces a runoff, but he might cost William Ruto some votes because he's targeting the same audience as William Ruto does.
Wajakoya's unexpected popularity, analysts say, is coming from his campaign pledge to legalize outlawed cannabis in Kenya. In a telephone interview with VOA, the professor of law turned politician said he wishes to position Kenya as a dominant player in the anti-venom market and said he will encourage snake farming to help pay off Chinese debt. Despite his polling numbers, Wajakoya said he was confident of winning the election outright.
I'm not going to cause a runoff because I'm the one winning the previous election. So the issue of a runoff doesn't make no sense to me.
His agenda is attracting many, especially young voters. Policy and governance analyst Gabriel Muthuma explains why.
He's introduced us to his narrative of marijuana, snakes, snails, and hyenas. And yeah, to a certain level, he has been able to have a crowd who kind of think the same with him and believe he has something to offer as far as being a president in this country go.
Kenya's election law requires that a presidential candidate win more than 50% of the national vote to be declared the winner. The August poll will be Kenya's third election under the constitution established in 2010. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The death toll in ethnic clashes at Sudan's Blue Nile state has reached 105, with another 291 wounded. Fighting broke out in the southern state, which borders Ethiopia and South Sudan, on July 11th between members of the Berti and Hausa ethnic groups. Troops were deployed last Saturday to stop the fighting, and the situation is now calm, according to State Health Minister Jamar Nassar, who told the French news agency. But Nassar said the current challenge is sheltering the displaced. He was speaking by phone from the state capital Al-Damizan, some 460 kilometers south of Khartoum. The United Nations says more than 17,000 people have fled their homes from the fighting, with 14,000 sheltering in three schools in Al-Damizan. The Nigerian army says it's found one of the so-called Chibok girls who were kidnapped 8 years ago by the Islamic extremist group Boko Haram. The French news agency AFP reported this is the third in recent weeks. 276 schoolgirls aged 12 to 17 were abducted from their boarding school in Chibok in northeastern Nigeria in 2014. Their plight sparked a global campaign under the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. Christopher Musa, commander of troops in the region, presented Ruth Bitoruis, 24, along with her two-year-old son to journalists. He did not say when she was found. She was 16 when she was kidnapped. She said she escaped at night and walked for 3 days through the bush before reaching the town of Bama and approached troops. 57 of the original captives have managed to escape, and another 80 have been exchanged for Boko Haram commanders. Other girls were later found, but more than 100 still remain missing. According to a propaganda video, many were forcibly married to Boko Haram fighters. The White House announced yesterday it will hold a U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit December 13th through the 15th. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says the Biden administration is seeking more engagement in Africa to elevate the importance of democracy, knowing that it needs to play a stronger leadership role. Otherwise, that space would be filled by other international actors, often those with nefarious interests, including non-state actors like violent extremist groups.
I think the U.S. is trying to assert more leadership and, advance some common interest with Africa.
Do you think that the Biden administration is trying to counter China's influence in Africa by holding this summit?
I don't think that's the primary motivation, and it's often overlooked that the U.S. has far longer ties in Africa than is commonly recognized. The United States has cooperation efforts, dating back at least 8 decades in Africa across a whole host of fronts, economic, developmental, humanitarian, trade, cultural, security. And so there's a lot of common interest there between the United States and Africa. And I think the primary motivation is really to put a positive trajectory on what this means and to reaffirm those shared interests. And I think there's going to be a very strong focus on economic opportunities and how to expand U.S. foreign direct investment and trade and economic cooperation on the continent.
I'm thinking back on the 2014 first Africa Leaders Summit that was held by President Obama then. Do you expect heads of state to attend this summit as they did back then?
Absolutely. I think there's a strong interest on the part of many African leaders in engaging with the United States. Indeed, I would go so far as to say, the United States is the preferred partner for many African countries. The question has been, how engaged is the United States going to be in Africa? And so I think there will be a high level of receptivity. African governments would welcome more U.S. investment, more trade, and more job creation that would be generated from more fulsome U.S. engagement on the continent.
Several African countries, as you know, are mired in conflict. Ethiopia, Burkina Faso, Mali, South Sudan, Sudan, just to name a few. Will the Biden White House be able to focus on what then-President Obama called the ingredients of progress when he hosted that first summit, strengthening governments on which economic development and free societies depend, he said, the rule of law, accountable and transparent institutions? Is that even attainable in some of these countries?
Well, I think it certainly is attainable. And you're right, there are 16 African countries, actually, that are in conflict in one form or another right now. And so there has been deterioration. Moreover, this summit will be happening in a period where we've seen a considerable democratic backsliding on the continent. There are now more authoritarian-leaning countries than democratic-leaning countries in Africa. That wasn't the case just a few years ago. And this is a result of, the coups we've seen. There have been 6 coups in Africa since 2020. There have been 13 African leaders who have circumvented term limits since 2018. And so there's been some very definite democratic backsliding. I think, one of the questions for the summit is how strongly issues of governance are going to be emphasized. Because as we've seen, countries that uphold democratic norms are more likely to respect the rule of law. They're more likely to avoid conflict. They're going to be better development partners.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam in Washington. President Kais Saied hopes Tunisia's voters will ratify his proposed new constitution in a referendum Monday, effectively giving him unchecked power. The president could hire and fire a prime minister without input from the legislature. A no-confidence motion in the president's hand-picked cabinet would need a two-thirds majority. The president could dissolve parliament but could not be impeached. Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi such a new constitution would move Tunisia back towards a system reminiscent of the one in force before the Arab Spring.
Well, actually, Mohammed, this new constitution was written by Kais Saied himself. and it would give him unlimited and unchecked powers. There is no separation of powers in this new constitution, and there is no checks and balances, especially on the executive branch and especially on the powers of the president himself. He basically wrote in the constitution that he's accountable to no one for any actions that he commits or undertakes while exercising his duties. Basically, he's immune from any criticism. I think this constitution is much worse than the one we had before the revolution. And even Bourguiba and Ben Ali did not have such unlimited and unchecked powers as the ones that Qais Saied will have if this constitution is adopted.
The new constitution does not specify a percentage of voters that would make voting on the constitution legitimate. So even boycotting the referendum by political parties and angry voters would not prevent the president from ratifying his draft. Saied has appointed a new elected commission, casting some doubt over the credibility of any vote on Monday. How could that impact the democratic transition in Tunisia?
Well, I mean, I think that many scholars and experts in Tunisia and politicians said that if this constitution is adopted and is passed, it will be the end of democracy in Tunisia. There is no question about it. There is no threshold for ratifying this constitution. I mean, this is really ironic. Many people in Tunisia have insisted on having a threshold of at least 50% of the registered voters, and at least two-thirds of those who vote must approve the new constitution. This is what you typically have in any referendum on the constitution anywhere in the world. But Qais Saied has refused to put a threshold. And so theoretically, this constitution could pass or could be ratified with only 10% or 15% of the registered voters, which of course is a joke. All the political parties in Tunisia, with the exception of one small party, are calling on Tunisians to boycott the referendum. And that is why I expect the turnout to be very low, maybe around 10% or maximum 15%. But that is also why Qais Saied has replaced most of the members of the Electoral Commission, the governors, and even the judges. He has replaced them, and he has fired the independent judges who will be in charge of running and monitoring the referendum. So clearly, there is almost a certainty that the results will be rigged in his favor and will be whatever he wants them to be.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Washington wants to foster billions of dollars of investment in Africa. That's the message that Alice Albright, chief executive officer for the U.S. development agency Millennium Challenge Corporation, gave to the U.S.-Africa Business Summit being held at the Moroccan city of Marrakesh. She emphasized that Washington wants to create jobs and build inclusive, sustainable economic growth and prosperity across Africa. According to the French news agency AFP, the Marrakesh meeting, organized by the private group, the Corporate Council on Africa, brings together African political and business leaders, as well as decision makers and investors from the U.S. private sector. Moroccan Foreign Minister Nassar Bourouti said, as he opened the talks yesterday, it is time for Africa to play its natural and central role on the international stage. Fighting climate change, the energy transition, food security, health, agriculture, infrastructure, new technologies, and the digital divide are among the key issues. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.